up kids bumping Fuji La, wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wear the mask, but how long will it last?
Shit was ill, man. It was ill. Yo, bullets everywhere, guns, smoke.
And that was the Fugees with The Mask and a song from The Mask. The Mask from an album called The Score. And before that, we heard The Clash with Magnificent Seven from Sandinista. And we may hear more of that later if certain things happened. I don't know what better way to put that. And we're back when you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And your co-hosts today are myself, Jeff,
Diego,
and Jai.
We're just talking to Jai about how he became a socialist at such a young age, which is great. Took me a little longer than that.
Well, that proves that that statistic, the millennials are more favorable to socialism than the 80s when Soviet Union was still around, the Cold War was still around.
Yeah. Are you technically a millennial or are you pre-millennial? Or
in terms of the pseudoscientific definition of, because generations are nonsense anyways.
It is, yeah.
I am not officially a millennial, no.
So what are they calling your generation then?
We don't have a name yet because don't care about us yet because the generation thing is nonsense anyways. So
they used to call us Generation X, the unknown.
Yeah. I don't know what I was. I'm baby boomer, just on the end of it. Yeah.
I think officially we are Generation Z, but no one calls us that because millennials is just better.
They don't need to malign us yet. The zombie thing.
Yeah. They don't need to malign us yet. They can just still keep pretending that we're millennials with their pseudoscience.
There's an article.
Which is the regeneration of the world. Just live with it.
Yeah. There's an article we're not going to have time for today, unfortunately, but I want to point out to our listeners by Paul Street, December 29th, counterpunch.org. Quote, against identitarian and generational divide and rule. Now I understood the identitarian part, but I was like, what's he talking about generational? And he does get into what you're talking about, like there's this pseudoscience floating around that the baby boomers were spoiled or stuff like that. I don't know if they said it
about the greatest generation when they were born. They said it about the baby boomers. They said it about my mom's generation.
I have some stories about the greatest generation.
Generation X.
I got some stories about the greatest generation. They were not the greatest, I'm afraid, in many ways. They would be the first to admit it, I think, too.
The greatest generation.
World War II, yeah.
I thought it was World War One.
No, two.
Okay.
Yeah, two. I don't know, World War One was...
World War One was like
they just kind of ignore
they
it.
They
kind of
ignored it. They wanted to just like put that.
I think
it's because of the Bolshevik, the revolution.
Yeah.
They wanted to like kind of like. Well, let's also, just pretend it didn't happen.
All you have to do with Woodrow Wilson is just for a moment, just for a little moment, think about really what that regime was like, the Wilson regime. Completely racist.
So
completely
racist.
Militaristic, despite, we're not going to go to war. Clear representative of the rich.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, a Democrat.
He said peace on earth for the prosperity of capitalism.
Yeah. What's the phrase? He viewed Birth of a Nation for the first like feature viewing, in the White House. And Birth of a Nation, if you don't know, is,
racist.
It's an incredibly racist movie that
We did that.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait.
That was a weird thing. I'll get into that in a second. But The Birth of a Nation was a propaganda film made about the Klan that literally created the concept of cross-burning. And then the Klan saw the movie and they're like, that's a great idea.
And it strengthened Jim Crow.
Oh, so they got it from the movie. They said, hey, that's a great idea.
Exactly.
Tomorrow I'm going to go cross-burn.
It strengthened Jim Crow,
Yeah, the movie romanticizing slavery and romanticizing the Klan created...
Director was D.W. Griffiths, who had a lot of power at the time, and the movie was shown around.
And that was aired in the White House by Woodrow Wilson's request.
Yeah, and Wilson, of course, threw Eugene Debs into prison and created basically a police state during World War One.
Yeah.
You couldn't even talk against the war. I'm against the war. Boom. Federal prison.
Yep.
The draft. They had a draft, I believe.
Yes, they did.
Let's see what else. The rampant inequality of the time, you know, leading into the 20s, which was a time where capitalism. You know, we're taught the flapper era.
Yeah.
The
roaring 20s.
Yeah, the roaring 20s when the repression against the workers was absolutely deadly. Yeah. Absolutely deadly. Speaking of Gatsby, I read a, you know, I was an English major in college, right?
Mm.
So this was after college, of course, I had to discover this. I read F. Scott Fitzgerald. He was okay, you know, Gatsby and all that. After college, I remember I was riding a bus one time, Greyhound bus, and I had taken out a collection of F. Scott Fitzgerald's short stories. He had a short story called May 5th, 1919 or something like that. Mm. I could have the title a bit wrong. It was all about mobs of right-wingers stoked up by the government and by other, you know, larger money forces to basically go and trash the offices of the IWW or some left union group.
Mm.
And it was all about this guy encountering that, these crazed soldiers and stuff on the street when he was just visiting a friend in a city. So you can see the guy was Fitzgerald, obviously. And,
yeah.
You know, and what's going on? Oh, and
was he a socialist
this mob.
Or semi-conscious?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I always wanted to research it, and I haven't. You know, my fault, but I haven't.
I would guess he's
that.
Probably
he was
leaning
sympathetic,
on the
probably liberal, right?
Well, back then utopian. It was also a different situation where communism wasn't a. Ooh,
no, it was. No. This is the first Red Scare.
Yeah,
it was
this
the Palmer Raids, 1919. 20s. You should read about that. 1917, 1919. The Palmer Raids. They used a. The Bolshevik Revolution as an excuse to go after civil liberties,
mm-hmm.
and guess who the main target was? Immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Immigrant socialists.
Yep. Especially Eastern European immigrants.
Yep, they demonized them. They tossed them out of the country. Tens of thousands. I think it was 40,000 or something like that.
Emma Goodman was in.
Emma Goodman got tossed.
They
yep.
executed a few anarchists.
Yep. They just a general clampdown, and that's what Fitzgerald was writing about, the way that mobs were used, mob violence was used. And so Wilson presided over most of that stuff, if not all of it. When did he die, or how did he leave office? I don't remember.
I don't think he died. He left office.
Yeah, there's no justice.
1920, think was the end of his term.
So he presided over a great deal of that, maybe the whole thing in a way, or that episode of it of the Red Scare and all that.
Yeah.
The guy's complete scum, and yet we're taught he's some sort of League of Nations hero or something. Yeah, League of Nations. Great. Yeah. Imperialism.
Yeah, you know. UPenn refers to him as one of their great success stories because he was president of UPenn for a while in his heyday before he was president.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still talk about him like he's this hero.
Yeah. Yep.
And I just sat there and I was like, this is the man that screened Birth of a Nation in the White House and fought in the bloody World War.
We're
going
to get into the new Birth of a Nation. That's why I was hesitant to watch that movie.
I have to do one thing before you guys talk about that. Every hour we have to say the following. We're WMFO Medford. WMFO in Medford. Sorry, go ahead.
So there was
I didn't watch it because I was like, I'm scared. Even took this and flipped it.
Yeah, so there was... I think this was just a terrible marketing thing in terms of like the name. I think that there's this gigantic gap in historical memory, especially in the US. I think that they just didn't realize that Birth of a Nation was the name of that terrible like Klan fetishizing movie.
See, I'm not from this country, so even in Cuba, we heard about
really,
that. Yeah,
that's crazy.
And when I seen it, I was like,
yeah, it's not.
I was like, why would it even go there?
It's not about the Klan at all. It's actually the opposite. It's about like multiracial, like working class organizing.
Oh, okay, but the title threw me off.
Yeah, the title's like, bad. The title's bad. Yeah, the title's very bad.
Why don't you just say I don't know. The Slave Rebellions or something like that.
That would have been a better name. Yeah.
Speaking of... I'm sorry. I'm not continuing that I have to do some other things here for the station. We have PSAs, public service announcements. So, sorry. Mm. I apologize. But
no worries.
This is one I've done before. I really like it. Numbers to think about worldwide prison populations. This is from UN data. The United States has the world's largest documented prison population, both in absolute and proportional terms. Mm-hmm. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, more than 2.2 million prisoners are behind bars in the United States, a rate of 730 per 100,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
China, which is four times more populous than the United States, is a distant second, with 1.51 million people in prison, a rate of 117 per 100,000, while Russia has the second highest rate, 606 per 100,000, for a total of 865,000 prisoners in Russia. Now, these are numbers to think about, a message of the public interest from WFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Now, one reason I read this is when you were talking about Black Lives Matter and the basic demand of stop murdering people, I immediately thought, and it's a free country. That phrase is always going through my head because, like, Diego mentioned the Cold War. You grew up during the Cold War. It's just like, bam, 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 bam. Freest country in the world, best country in the world. Now, I've been lucky enough to travel. It's not the best country in the world. Buy me, if some right-winger's listening and said, love it or leave it, give me the plane ticket, give me a job.
Choose your country.
And I'm leaving it. You know, but one thing I learned when I did leave it, Reagan was in power, and I said, I'm out of here. And I went to France and lived off of what money I'd saved up for a while. One thing I learned is the long reach of the United States, especially culturally, which isn't that, you know, bad enough, but politically too.
Yeah.
Huge. I end up in France just as a socialist communist government is reprivatizing everything they had nationalized, including the banking system, under pressure of the French capitalists and the United States and world imperialism. But anyway, that's another story. Anyway, so this reminded me of this. You know, if you're in a country with the most people in prison in the world, why is everyone going around saying it's a free country?
Also, around six to eight million people that are on probation or in some ways at the mercy of the legal system still, that are also not included in that 2.2 million.
And of those people you're mentioning, most of them can't vote in most states. They can't even live in public housing, I don't think, in some states.
Can't live in public housing. They don't have access to certain welfare type of resources. Yeah. Completely ineligible.
Wow.
Well, the history of this country, they set it up in a way that it was only for like people that workers that were classified as workers. But if you were a servant, which was mostly African Americans were in servant roles at the time, they were they were disqualified. Like
goes all the way back to the New Deal.
That's back in the 20s. You know.
Oh yeah, the New Deal, the whole racist side of the New Deal. The whole thing. No one stops to think about Roosevelt. Basically, is in power because of being. I want to go beyond the word deals, being in power with the Jim Crow South, the Southern Democrats.
Yep.
Uniformly Democratic, uniformly Jim Crow, racist. That's Roosevelt's base, part of it, a big part of it. You know, he's in power based on that. And then, so they enact, like you're saying, Diego, they're enacting social welfare legislation under pressure of mass movements, by the way, not because they were good.
Yeah.
and then finding ways to make it racist.
And sexist. You know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you serve in a streetcar, what do they call those? Like Malcolm X used to be a server in a...
Pullman Porter.
Exactly. You're disqualified. You're as a server. Yeah. No, you're...
They eventually got unionized, too, though. They fought back. Yeah.
Exactly. They fought back. Yeah. But before that, I mean, why weren't they included? They're workers. They're working. It doesn't matter what, you know. They're still working. They're still putting value to an economy.
Yep. And to this day, agricultural laborers are exempted from minimum wage laws and all sorts of other health and safety.
Yeah.
The more things change under capitalism, the more they stay the same, to use a cliche. One last PSA, public service announcement. Storm season, emergency preparedness. It's storm season with power outages. They have a picture of the 1978 blizzard in the Northeast, which was really horrible. In storm season with power outages and weather-related emergencies, more likely than the rest of the year, so be prepared ahead of time by having a couple of gallons of drinking water and at least a few days' worth of healthy, tasty, ready-to-eat food. Already stored in your home. Now, two problems there. I'm just going to editorialize. This is not there. Who can afford that? But secondly, if it's ready to eat, and I don't think it's healthy and tasty, too. You know, it's that kind of stuff you buy for emergencies, you know? Anyway, let other people scramble to the supermarket and wait on long lines while you safely ride out the store from the comfort of your home. It's kind of a selfish ending.
It's very
a public service message.
Terrible ending.
WFO Medford, Tufts Education Radio. Some of these are progressive.
Let everybody go
not so much.
Yeah.
Laugh at the misery of your neighbors. I'm nice and warm.
Can we go back to the prison statistics one?
Libertarian mindset right there. I'm good. I got everything I need.
I'm not in prison.
You should have stocked up, buddy.
For now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, Debs' quote, what was that famous quote by Debs? You familiar with that? As long as there's a man in prison or something, or blah, blah, blah. You know that one?
I've heard that before, yeah.
It's a brilliant quote. I wish I knew it by heart. Anyway, so this is a good segue into something we discussed off-air of talking about today. Because of the cold, the vicious cold that we're having here, record-breaking low temperatures, it's causing, obviously, a lot of problems, but it also exacerbating chronic problems, making worse chronic problems that exist under capitalism here in the United States and elsewhere. And one of the ones that comes to mind, even the corporate media is mentioning this a little bit, especially around that they do this around the holidays when they get into their charity mode. Homeless people. I mean, it's just a huge number of homeless people in the United States right now. Many cities, the rents are just way too high for people to afford. There's a relative shortage.
And they're busting out people?
Well, that's not what I was going to get into, but yeah.
San Francisco, there was a thing on Democracy Now. Look it up. I think The Guardian did an article called Bust Out, where American cities have funds. If they want to, this is where they're dealing with their homeless population, is here. Here's a ticket. Just get out. Mm. Go. You know?
Leave town. Eventually, they come back.
You know? Yeah. But yeah, they get a ticket and they get bust out.
Yeah.
You can go anywhere else. Just not here.
Yeah.
And that San Francisco was the main focal point of that interview or that.
Yeah. Well, locally, what was the sticks I heard? An 18% increase or an increase of 118 people or something. I don't know. In the already full Pine Street Inn, which is the main shelter in downtown Boston or in Boston. What got me thinking about this is just the hearing about the corporate media, the cold and so on, but also how every year relentlessly they do this, moment of noticing the homeless. And this is when people are dying literally on the streets. Mm-hmm. Oh, I also saw this thing. I don't know if you, you're not on Facebook yet, Diego, but.
The public servant?
Yeah.
Yeah, that looks very good.
Doesn't that look good?
It does look very
good. There's supposedly a movie coming out, if it ever makes to the theaters, mm-hmm. directed by Emilio Estevez. About a public library, and this could be the BPL. Have you guys been to the Boston Public Library? Always a lot of homeless people there.
Never been, no.
There's a lot in the Cambridge one.
And Worcester too.
Yeah. They basically, long story short, in the trailer, it's the guy from The Wire. I forgot his name, but he had a great quote I was sending around. You know, the guy that plays the
main character?
No, well, it's hard to say who the main character is in The Wire, but he's one of the main characters.
I've never watched The
Michael.
Wire.
Anyway, so he's in this, Emilio Estevez, some other actors you'll recognize, and set in a city, and the homeless are spending their days in the public library to stay warm, and then are kicked out at night, and apparently one or two die on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets the director of the library and other people thinking, what's going on with this? But especially the homeless people themselves, they basically decide to stay in one night and mm-hmm. stay in the library. Yeah. This is illegal, quote unquote.
Yeah.
They try to seize
the library for the night just to stay warm. Yeah. And it seems like the police are going to try to brutally repress them for trying to not die, which is very, very
capitalistic.
Very sadly accurate.
Yeah, very, very accurate. Yep. And what we got into earlier briefly about how the capitalist system is based on coercive violence ultimately, mm-hmm. because otherwise all these common sense things, if you're hungry you'll eat, if you're homeless you'll find shelter, if you're whatever, don't happen under capitalism because they're mm-hmm. illegal, by the way, I think there's trailers are pieced together in weird ways sometimes, so you might not even see what's in the trailer in the film, but it seems to me like from the trailer that there's a guy that starts off against it, like mm-hmm. a library guy in this chair, and then becomes for it.
Yeah.
There's a scene where one of the cops is like,
it's like he's radicalized by the library.
He takes his bow tie off and goes like this. gives a fist. I love that scene. I can't wait to see that. I will definitely see that.
Called The Servant?
No.
The Public Servant, I think.
I think it's called The Public, isn't it, or something like that? Just The Public? Who's got the magic phone? You got the magic phone. All right. So while Jai is looking that up, let's introduce this topic real quick. So I found this article by Mother Jones from November, so they were anticipating the situation. But there's also an angle on this that is really disturbing because they're talking about children here. 4 million people were homeless last year. 4 million. I'm not repeating the 4 million. The title's repeating the 4 million. So, quote, 4 million young people. There's more than that in total. 4 million young people were homeless last year. 4 million. Subheading, black youth are 83% more likely to be without housing than other young people. 83% more likely. And then there's another, just a quote that starts the article, sort of a random quote. In Hollywood, and I just saw this thing on Facebook of a so-called Skid Row, which went on for like miles of homeless people. Like Skid Row is like an antiquated term for homeless populations back when there weren't that many homeless, relatively speaking, in the 60s or whatever. Yeah. 50s and 60s, like people with chronic alcoholics.
And if you've ever been to LA, that's like,
yeah. Well, but now Beverly Hills, you can't call that Skid Row. Yeah, you got to call that like a huge part of the city where they've concentrated the homeless. So
it's
in Hollywood,
downtown area almost.
Yeah, in Hollywood, 75% of the homeless population were under the age of 21 in 2014. 75% in this one place in Hollywood. So then it goes on to say, this is for Edwin Rios from Mother Jones, November 17th, 2020. Nearly 4.2 million kids and young adults without a parent or guardian are homeless across the United States over the course of a year. A new study from the University of Chicago revealed the startling statistic this week focused specifically on homeless unaccompanied youth between the ages of 13 and 25, a population that till now has been rarely studied comprehensively. Young people of color and LGBT youth are much more likely to be homeless at some point in the year. African-American youth are 83% more likely than other youth to be without shelter, and LGBT youth a whopping 120% more likely to be without housing than other young people. The report is called Missed Opportunities, Youth Homelessness in America, published in the Journal of Adolescent Health in early November. A rare understanding of the scale of youth homelessness in the U.S. A national study surveyed more than 226,000 people, and then it goes into the methodology of the study. I don't have time to go into much, but it's more comprehensive than a lot of them. And then finally, it's important to study the population because experience with homelessness put kids and young adults at a higher risk of substance use and abuse, mental health difficulties, dropping out of school, and unemployment. I would add freezing to death.
Yeah.
Young people cannot succeed if they are worried about where they're going to sleep the next night. Youth homelessness is not an event. It's not something usually where you have a young person who is stably housed one day and the next day they're on the street. It's often young people have adversity over time that accumulates to first runaway episodes or couch surfing and extends into deeper forms of homelessness over time if those issues aren't resolved, if the young people don't get the support and services they need. That's what I hate about Mother Jones. It ends up with this like liberal stuff at the end always. Yeah. What support and services, man? There's not enough housing. Anyway, so we're talking about this because
the movie's called The Public, by the way. You were right.
The Public, yeah. Yeah. I was right for once.
Yes.
I'm forgetting all these names. And I remember one name, probably because I shared that with about 5,000 people.
It was really good.
Yeah.
Is it out yet or is it going to be on the theater?
I think it's supposed to be out soon, but I don't know that.
It says February? 2017 release date, so I think it should be out.
2017?
Is it an independent film?
I think it's indie, yeah.
For some reason, I have 2018 February in mind for a release date, but I have no proof of that. One thing I was thinking, this is jumping beyond the obvious horror of so many youth not having a place to stay at night, not being homeless, is there's another aspect to this that's killer. You kind of alluded to it earlier, Diego. Mm-hmm. So if you're like my family, you're scraping to save money. And then you get hit by this like extreme weather. We got to crank up the heat now all the time. Normally we wouldn't be doing it. We have this pellet stove, and we use that. But when it gets below 20, you got to turn on the regular heat no matter what, and you got to keep it running a lot, or the pipes are going to freeze.
Right.
So I just heard on the news there have been two fires in the area recently from people trying to unfreeze their pipes with blow torches. Mm-hmm. This happens a lot in the winter around here. So it's not just like, the horrible situation of homeless people. It's like people that, for most people, there's no subsidies for heat. I know there's some, but there's no subsidies for that, So you have a year where all of a sudden you're paying all this for oil, hundreds of dollars. I mean, it costs hundreds of dollars to get half a tank of oil. It costs natural gas. Here's a statistic I heard. We were talking about this off air. Mm-hmm. Natural gas is more expensive in New England than anywhere else in the world. That's what I heard. Okay, I can't back that up. Didn't cite that.
Why?
But yeah, why? I think it has to do with delivery. But
we don't have any.
And the fact that the cold is to the extreme where
they can crank it up. Yeah, they can use site demand as a way to crank up the price and make a ton of money. So what I'm thinking is like, we should develop a whole transitional program with this, like subsidies. Well, first of all, nationalize. Take under public ownership the energy companies, because this is ridiculous. You need heat to survive, right? Mm. And then, and as a step towards that, create
how
subsidies.
Wasn't in the times when you were growing up, you were talking about in the 70s, how things were more... something broke down, it'd be fixed, not in a week, it'd be like immediate.
Okay, so the utility companies were heavily regulated. Mm. So you had lower prices in general, but it was still expensive heat. For example, talking about, I think it was, I don't know if this is off air or on air, we're talking about fighting around about money. I think it was off air.
Mm-hmm.
That was a constant thing growing up for me, like in the post-war upswing still, but still it was just like completely fighting for money. Maybe because we had four kids or something, I don't know. And heat was a big one. My father's always turning down the heat. My mother's always turning up the heat. Boom, fight, you know?
Mm.
Who turned up the heat? Was like a,
we're trying to like save money here.
That's like a curse thing. Yeah, no, that's like accusation of high importance, of really severe consequences. Who turned up the heat? So, you know, we'd start looking at each other at the dinner table. It's like you're being accused of murder or something, you know? Who turned up the heat? Wasn't me. Even if I did it wasn't me. You know, even if you have pictures, it wasn't me. I didn't turn up the heat. Leave me alone, you know? So it's like this. Anyway, I'm just thinking, like, there's a lot of people that are going to lose a lot of money that can't afford to, on top of people that are just going to outright freeze to death or get in a very dangerous situation. We've already had pipes burst in our house because we tried to keep the heat low a few years ago when there was the cold weather, not even bad as this. So we learned our lesson, and now we're just going to, you know, pour our paychecks into the oil now. So right now we have a situation where in New England, this cold weather is supposed to continue now into next week. So it's going to be like 2 weeks at least. And things are getting canceled and stuff, and people are probably freezing to death even as we speak. You know, they do these homeless censors every January, census in Boston every January. You know what it consists of? A PR event for the mayor, whoever the mayor is at the time, some Democratic Party idiot, going around and counting physically the homeless. Do you know how many people you're going to miss that way? You know, they do it one night of the year. A real cold night when everyone's probably in the shelters or trying to get in the shelters. My understanding of going in the shelters is that you have to give up basically all your possessions to get in. Is that, I don't know if that's true or not. And so a lot of people try to avoid it. And you try to avoid it, you're going to be in some, you know, I've run into homeless people sleeping out in the weirdest places because they're there because they avoid the cops and avoid going to the shelter, you know? So they're in this really strange places. And Menino, or whoever the mayor is, they're not going to find, I almost said Menino, they're not going to find those people. Anyway, so it's a really rough time right now. And it's at a time where at the same time you're hearing all this propaganda from the corporate media of how great the economy's doing. The full employment narrative, which is a complete lie. I mean, the corporate media contradicting itself in that.
Yeah.
So they had some guy that actually said, no, it's not full employment yet. You know, their own sources. I was amazed that usually most of them are saying it's full employment. So we also want to talk about at the same time this horrible homelessness crisis happening. There's basically a increased inequality. I have an article here from something called Portside. Have you guys heard of that? I think it's a left-wing site.
No.
And it says extreme poverty returns to America. You had a couple articles about that, right? The Bezos thing. And,
yes.
But before we get into some of the individuals responsible, this is extreme poverty returns to America, dated December 28th, a few days ago.
When did it ever left America? That's my question.
That's true, but what they're going to say is something that's interesting. Wait till you hear this. You're right. You're absolutely right. I think the guy kind of acknowledges that, though. He talks about, like,
probably more of a headline
being told to, being told to finish his food when he was a kid and all that stuff.
That's a big one.
Okay, so, he does say there's never been a country free of inequality and poverty. Maybe the Soviet Union for a short time, but anyway. But their rapid growth over the first two decades has undermined any professed commitment to equal opportunity or the belief that the nation's prosperity rests on the well-being of ordinary Americans. In the 19th and 20th centuries, unfettered capitalism in the United States led to a rapid economic expansion characterized by widening class disparities, a profound economic insecurity among the poor, a recipe that contributed to the crisis of the Great Depression. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying the guy's not a liberal here, but wait till you hear this, though. This is what I mean by, I think that he says, look, let's see, where did it go? The growth of extreme poverty in the land of plenty is an indicator that we shouldn't be talking about how to slash spending on social programs, but how to expand services and better meet the needs of the vulnerable among us. Now, listen to this. 1.5 million American households, live in extreme poverty today, nearly twice as many as 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it is getting worse. It's not just, you're right, Diego, it's always existed. And sometimes it's worse than this.
Mm-hmm.
But within the last 20 years, this has gotten worse. If this trend continues, we will undoubtedly see the number of extremely poor Americans rise dramatically, imperiling the values of democracy and human rights. Well, okay, there you go. This guy's living in a bubble, but yeah. Whatever. A similar point, 40 million Americans live in poverty, nearly half in deep poverty, which UN investigators, this is something the article pins itself on. The UN sent a 15-day tour, a special reporter on rapporteur, whatever that means, on extreme poverty and human rights, has just dropped a 15-day tour of the United States. So Philip Alston, United Nations special rapporteur on extreme poverty and human rights, has just wrapped a 15-day tour of the United States. His team visited Alabama, California, Puerto Rico, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Okay. Let's see. Okay, 40 million parents. Yeah, the United States has the highest child poverty rate at 25% in all the countries in the developed world. Then there are the extremely poor who live on less than $2 per person per day and don't have access to basic human services such as sanitation, shelter, education, and health care. These are people who cannot find work, who have used up their five-year lifetime limit on assistance. Isn't that a Clinton thing? You know, that five-year...
Yeah, that's a Clinton thing.
Yeah. Vote lesser evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't think of much more evil than that. Can you imagine someone thinking there, let's make 5 years. Let's just say, you can only be poor for 5 years. Can you imagine the mind that thinks that way? That's the mind of a sociopath. You know, I mean, you're majoring in neurology. You have to give us some answers here.
That's more of a psych thing, but I'm.
We're gonna get into that.
How poverty changes social.
Yeah,
social.
We're gonna get into how poverty changes the brain, but how does wealth change the brain?
Yeah, it turns you into a monster.
Yeah, a terrible monster.
Gotta protect those.
It's like the cookie monster. You know, he wants more and more. He can't have enough.
Yeah, the cookie monster. That's not good enough. We gotta find a better metaphor. The American dream is rapidly becoming the American illusion, as the U.S. now has the lowest rate of social mobility in any of the rich countries. Let us repeat that.
Interesting.
Because everyone thinks they're going to be...
That's
the next
a very interesting
millionaire.
Point.
Quote, the U.N. report says, the American dream is rapidly becoming the American illusion. It always has been, but let's not get into that right now. As the U.S. now has the lowest rate of social mobility of any of the rich countries. In 1981, the top 1% of adults earned on average 27 times more than the bottom 50% of adults. Today, the top 1% earns 81 times more than the bottom 50%, which might be a segue into the top three.
So I'm better off in Canada than here.
Oh, yeah.
Basically.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the love it or leave it thing.
Yeah.
Give me a ticket to Montreal.
Yeah.
Set me up in a little job.
I want to go to Toronto.
They have good health care there. You know, that's what universal health care does.
And they didn't get it through the Liberal Party.
Nope, they got it through mass movements.
The New Democrat, also the New Democratic Party.
Mm.
In 1964, forces, you know, unions, community groups, health care groups came together and started the New Democratic Party, a party to the left of the conservatives and the liberals.
Mm.
And just the threat of that party and the main plank of that party, national health care, boom, they got national health care.
Well, I got a cousin who lives there, and he says, I'm not a citizen. What they do is they renew the visa for 4 years. You have the same rights as any worker, health care, everything, pension, all that stuff. For 4 years, you have to renew it, obviously, but you don't have to be a citizen. But you still get the same rights. Where here, you have to be a citizen to get those rights.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the article you found? What was that from, by the way?
It was from... I think the publication is called Common Dreams, but it's probably something that's been published.
Did you want to refer to that? Is that why that was there?
No, I think you handed this to me. But
I don't do that. Do I hand people articles and stuff?
Yeah, all the time. You have an addiction to handing people articles. Let me pull up the article real quick.
The magic phone.
Yes, the magic phone. The magic phone. 1 second.
We're in Star Trek times.
Beam me up.
Yes, Common Dreams is the name of the publication.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also been liberals, probably all over, that's all right. Everywhere. So there are now three people in the U.S. who own as much wealth as the bottom 50%. Those three
I'm going to do air quotes on the word people just so people
yeah,
know.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that.
Three individuals.
Three individuals.
And we can round up.
Yeah.
And we can say... what's going on?
Yeah.
What are you trying to do?
In order from most exploitative and most parasitic to least relatively parasitic would be Jeff Bezos, CEO of Amazon, Bill Gates, CEO of Microsoft, and Warren Buffett, who does things that I don't know about. I think he does financial dealings and things of that sort.
Oh, he's considered a good capitalist by the liberals.
Yeah, he's considered a good, because he loves to talk
charitable
about...
charitable works.
Yeah, he loves to talk about charity. He loves to talk about how his taxes are way too low. Yeah. But I don't see him doing a whole lot of work to actually change that materially.
I don't see him stopping to exploit labor in nature.
Yeah, I don't see him actually paying his workers their value.
Yeah.
I don't see any of that happening. Yeah. So interesting how he's so allegedly progressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, these three individuals own as much wealth as the bottom 50% of the population. Now that gets even more interesting when you talk about how just a few months ago it was five individuals, and just a few months before that it was eight.
Pretty sure it'll be King Rat.
Yeah,
one individual.
And like literally 6 months ago it was five people.
So,
and around a year before that it was eight, and around a year before that it was like around 20
people.
It should
be like a little thing where we just put them, those three, in the room and say, okay, there's only three of yous left. Go ahead. Let the gun go.
That's basically what's happening. That's the brutality of how fast capital is being accumulated.
Yeah, rapid.
It's incredibly parasitic.
Rapid.
We've gone from around 20 people owning as much wealth as the bottom 50% to now three in the course of a few years.
Yep.
It's insane.
They now, you told me earlier, I don't know if you just mentioned this or not, Bezos was not at the top. He just wormed his way to the top.
Yes, he wormed his way to the top very recently, like within 6 months.
Head of Amazon.
He has defeated Bill Gates as the richest man in the world.
Yeah. And that's called success by some people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're living off
of... He's the guy who bought Whole Foods.
Bought Whole Foods. Yep. Brutally anti-union. His workers fall asleep on the job because they're so overworked.
He also provided jobs and laid them off within months.
Yeah.
Because what happened around here in Everett.
Mm.
And now he wants to expand out towards Western Mass.
Interesting.
You know, someone listening might think we script this show and we don't. But this is a great segue into an article by a member of Socialist Alternative named Tony Wilsden. I think it's going to be the new issue of Socialist Alternative in January, but
very
it's also
article,
already available at socialistalternative.org, called, quote, Amazon Warehouse Workers, Will the Sleeping Giant Awake? And, well, let me just, unless you want to say something, because I'm going to give an extensive quote here. Did you want to say something else before that?
No, not really. I just, Bezos, there was also a meme posted on this very recently about, you know, kind of going into some of how Bezos was able to become the richest man and usurp Bill Gates was through the brutal, like, anti-worker things that he's been doing.
Some of that's in here.
Through further lowering and worsening workers' conditions, through overworking them to some of the degrees that article will talk about. It's not by accident.
Yeah.
It's through brutal repression of his workers.
Yep, absolutely. It's by design. Well, and also, it's, you know, when you hear some of these conditions, you're going to think, some of you might think, they're listening, you know, this is back to the robber baron days. Mm. And it is. So this is an article from December 30th. Isn't that yesterday? I found that yesterday. Okay. By Tony Wilsden, socialistalternative.org, under this section of our website called Workers' Movement. Rumblings are starting among new sections of the working class. Target workers in Christiansburg, Virginia, went on strike for 5 days in September, winning their key demand related to sexual and racial discrimination. These workers have started to move down the path of their grandfathers and grandmothers by learning that they have enormous power in the workforce if they unite and move into struggle. Most important is the start of struggle by workers at the huge Amazon warehouses. Warehouse workers and supporters protested low wages and brutal work conditions in Manhattan, New York in December. Warehouse workers in Amazon went on strike at the biggest Amazon warehouse in Italy in 2016. Underground organizing drives are starting in warehouses across the United States, or in the United States. In the U.S. alone, there are more than... Now, this is interesting. I didn't know this. In the U.S. alone, there are more than 50 gigantic buildings with over 40,000 full-time workers. The total workforce of Amazon is over 450,000.
Whoa.
Conditions are brutal. Yet, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is the richest man on earth with a wealth of over $100 billion, like we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. He makes more money in 1 minute than the average millennial makes in a year.
Can you repeat that? What?
Yes, he makes more money.
$100 billion.
Yeah. But listen, here's the thing that really catches. He makes more money in 1 minute than the average millennial makes in a year. Can you imagine that? What can you do in 1 minute to be worth $100 million? The answer is nothing. Yeah. This is the fiction of capitalism.
The answer is sit there and steal money from your workers.
Jeff Bezos runs Amazon. He does not. Workers run Amazon. Mm-hmm. And whenever you hear that, I'm addressing our listeners here. Comrades in the room here know this, but I'm addressing our listeners. And I don't mean to sound like preachy or whatever, but you got to understand. You just got to understand. The next time you hear so-and-so individual rich moron runs something, or not moron, they could be a genius, I don't care, idiot, bad person, runs something, like so-and-so runs something, it's a complete lie.
Yeah.
They don't run anything. They exploit other people's labor, and it's the labor, it's workers, it's us that runs things, runs society.
If Bezos doesn't show up to work for the next month, Amazon will be
fine.
I used
to work for Whole Foods. Every time the bosses would take their vacations and we're just running the show ourselves, I always tell them, I'll pull them over and say, guys, do you hear that? This is so much peaceful-er and better without the bosses. We just do what we got to do.
Yeah.
Because we're running the show no matter what.
Yeah.
You know? And look, things are still running. Things aren't falling apart. Right.
Exactly. The sky's not falling any penny. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, you know, I go for weeks at a time without really interacting with my supervisor in any deep way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I did that at my old job.
I mean, because
too.
It's just like they got their system in place. I follow their system. I don't have a choice. And it takes about 20 minutes to learn. And then you just do it, you know? Yeah. Anyway, back to Bezos. We had to think of ways to make fun of this guy. His name seems open to that. You know,
it's
Bezos,
so open to it. It's prepared.
Whatever.
Anyway.
He's Hispanic?
I don't think so.
I doubt it.
Bezos is like kisses.
Yeah, with a Z, though. Not an S. Okay. Yeah. He makes more money in 1 minute. Oh, I said that three times, but it's worth saying three times.
Yes, it is.
This is only possible because under capitalism, bosses control wages and working conditions and can therefore pay their workers less than the wealth that the workers' labor produces, as I was just getting into. I didn't even know that was the next sentence. Thank you, Tony. Very good. Deplorable conditions. Here's what Diego's getting into, and we were talking about. A reporter who went undercover to work at an Amazon warehouse in England wrote, quote, "Alone in a locked metal cage, 10 feet from my nearest colleague, a robot approaches from the shadows and thrusts a tower of shelves towards me. I have 9 seconds to grab and process an item to be sent for packing. A target of 300 items an hour for hour after relentless hour. Those who could not keep up with the punishing targets faced the sack," meaning being fired, "and some who buckled under the strain had to be attended to by ambulance crews. Many of the clocks have been covered over with tape by employees desperate not to be reminded how long is left of their shift." That sounds weird to me because I've worked in factories. I used to, you don't want to cover up the clock. I mean, try not to think about it, but you want to know, you want to look up and see. Anyway, that's really desperate. Another Amazon worker explained, "If you're way over to one side of the warehouse and lunch is called, you have 30 minutes from that point to clock out, eat, and come back. You're spending half your time waiting to be scanned out." So you're scanned out for lunch. Mm-hmm. "So you can be sure you're not stealing anything. It leaves you with about 10 minutes for food. One Amazon worker estimated he walks 13 miles a day in the warehouse." Now, workers in general face a daily barrage of arguments that they are powerless in the new gig economy and that labor unions are a thing of the past. However, the boss makes no money when workers withdraw their labor. That hasn't changed. There is still a powerful industrial sector in the U.S. Transportation workers, power workers, warehouse workers, grocery store workers, and others have lots of power if the union stepped up and mobilized union members. The high-tech and digital economy is creating new powerful sections of the working class. Workers in the huge Amazon distribution warehouses outside most cities and major towns have enormous potential power. So, like, what Tony's getting at here is, imagine if you shut down deliveries of Amazon products, which a lot of people have gotten used to using that. There are massive hubs which deliver products that represent a huge section of the economy based on a just-in-time, which we can use that, distribution system. If workers shut down these warehouses, Amazon will have to grant them improved wages and working conditions or lose billions of dollars. Outing the brutal working conditions at Amazon is a key part of mobilizing public opinion on the side of the workers, but even more essential and crucial to creating any lasting change would be the workers themselves organizing, especially organizing into unions. Undercover organizing inside the warehouse is essential. Socialist Alternative encourages workers to take up this important task of building core groups of workers in the warehouse, in the warehouses that can mushroom into the powerful unions of tomorrow. And we have some members of SA working in warehouses. We won't say where. And hopefully that's happening on the ground there.
To what Diego was saying. So the reason his last name is Bezos is because his stepfather is Cuban. That's why.
That hurts.
Cusano, I knew it. That
hurts.
Anti-Castroite.
Most likely, yeah.
Oh, gosh.
I fled that island because I was in prison. Blah, 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 blah. I'm going to be, you know, exploitator.
That shows the limits of identity politics right there. But anyway.
Sure does.
This is going to be a bit random sounding, but we're running out of time, and we'll come back to the main theme in a second. But I just wanted to point out this thing I saw in Money Watch. And yes, we read right-wing sources of information for data, business sources, and so on. Listen to this. Price of 40-year-old cancer drug hiked 1,400% by new owners. Prices for a cancer drug called Lomustine, L-O-M-U-S-T-I-N-E, have skyrocketed nearly 1,400% since 2013, putting a potentially life-saving treatment out of reach for patients suffering from brain tumors and Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Is it even possible to go 1,000-something%?
It went from $50 to around $760. Per pill?
$768 per pill, exactly. You memorized this one, huh?
$750 per pill.
Yep.
And it's a medication that's out there for 40 years, no longer protected by patents.
Life-saving medication.
But there's no generic version available, so much for the efficiency of capitalism, right? You don't even have a patent on the thing, and they can't create enough, et cetera. Anyway, check this out. Money Watch, December 26, 2017. I don't really have time to read much more about it.
That's sorry. Like that pump. That pump when they went to you've seen Sicko, right? With Michael Moore when he went to Cuba, and it was this little pump given to the people that suffered in 9/11, like the firemen and what have you. They say, "Oh, this pump costs 5 cents or 50 cents."
I think I've seen
that
before, yeah.
Where they were getting charged hundreds of dollars for that pump every month. Yep.
EpiPen's the same way. Costs literally cents to make. It's one of the most simplest, like, out of all the medicines that can be made. Epinephrine, the only thing simpler to make than epinephrine is like insulin. It's very simple. Yet they are now selling EpiPens. They massively raised the price by a few hundred percent, and it went from something that was already kind of not very affordable for most like working class families to something that's completely unaffordable. And they have. They have I forget the exact numbers, but they have a monopoly on it. So there's really nothing you can do. You just have to pray you don't go into anaphylactic shock, basically.
It sounds like you know a lot about this particular situation. Let me ask you a question. Mm-hmm. I heard that, remember when the EpiPen phenomena that you're describing, that it exploded in price and the greedy owner was...
They did bring it back down because of the gigantic...
That's my question.
Backlash.
I heard they didn't.
They didn't bring it all the way back down. Mm. They reduced how brutal the price increase was, but they still increased the price.
Wow.
Yeah.
I am going to actually give a couple quick quotes from this article because I found some other thing in it. It's interesting. Blah, blah, blah. Cancer drugs can easily surpass six figures per year to use. Mm. A study published earlier this year in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, oncology means cancer studies, study of cancers, I believe, or treatment, study and treatment of, found prices for 24 patented injectable Medicare Part B drugs rose on an average of 18% per year over the past 8 years, even on an inflation-adjusted basis. Prices continue to rise even when generic versions of the drug are available.
It's insane.
So just using, like, this, you know... you know, sort of rare, you know, somewhat rare production thing. What am I trying to say? They're basically fooling people.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways, a lot of different ways.
It's a battle of intellectual property.
Yeah.
They have the patent or they have the means to produce it, or only very few companies can produce it, so they can sell it for whatever they want.
And even if there is a generic drug available, you have to make sure you can get it. You know what I mean? Like, and there's no guarantee of that. Anyway,
it's the ultimate failure of the so-called free market.
Yeah, and the efficiency of capitalism.
Yeah,
you know, I think I was reading an article about this sort of thing, that there's drugs they don't develop.
Yep.
Because they just don't want to get involved with the amount of capital you need up front, and the government won't do it because
they're
supposed to not do that.
They just don't want to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of those things...
We could have saved DCE.
A lot of those things aren't even publicly available knowledge to us, right? Because it's corporate decision-making that happens.
Yep.
So there's all kinds of technological and cure advancements or treatment advancements that can be made that are either buried or not explored because they don't feel like funding it because it won't make them as much money.
Yep.
And we have no real way of being able to find that information out. And it's disgusting.
It is. So we're going to enter our lightning round here because we're running out of time. But I think we, in order to do justice, we're just going to have to say, you know, say to ourselves, there's certain things we couldn't cover and maybe next time. If you don't go back to school until
January 20th,
you could come on the show again.
Awesome.
Easily.
Yeah.
Or even if you're at school, you could do it too. But even before then, So this is the thing we alluded to earlier. I think we did. How poverty changes the brain.
Yeah.
The early results of a Boston nonprofit study reported through The Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
And your specialty is going to be neurology, right?
Yes.
That's what you're majoring in, probably.
Yeah,
you are.
Definitely.
Yeah. That's great. That's you know what you're going to major in already?
Yeah.
That's amazing. All right. But anyway, this caught our eyes because... Wow, poverty changes the brain. What do you mean? This is a very kind of Marxist way of looking at things.
Yes.
Although there's no Marxist.
And we were talking about we were talking about that off the air of how critical and how ever penetrating the materialism is into reality itself. That as I was saying earlier and why I'm a socialist, that my development as who I've become is a direct result of the material forces that surrounded my life in becoming a socialist. And that's the same thing that happens both like biologically with how your body functions and how you develop as a human and all these sorts of things. So this article is very interesting to me, especially from my like neurology future. And kind of like the major highlights, because we're kind of running out of time, is that, you know, the big cliff note, so to speak, is that poverty, as you can imagine, causes immense amounts of stress, and that stress is chronic. And as you can probably guess, chronic stress is not safe for the functionality of your brain.
I was telling him earlier, you know, I'm yelling at my mother, not directly, but just yelling. You know, because of this increase of rent.
Yeah,
I'm like, what's that going to do?
I'm
going to do this.
Yeah, these economic constraints.
And I'm taking out the stress on her as opposed to, you know, just, I don't know. And this isn't Christmas time, so.
Yeah.
And this massive amounts of stress, it just accumulates, and it just gets worse and worse. And in these chronic examples, it quite literally changes the way in which your brain functions.
Yep.
It can lower your basic like mental faculties, your ability to even focus. And so that's a large part of the reason, and there have been studies as going into this as well, why a lot of POC youth in inner cities
I say POC, you mean people of color.
Yeah, people of color, youth in inner cities do worse on exams and these sorts of things because they have more poverty to worry about. Yep. They have more potential acts of violence being acted against them to worry about, that their brains literally cannot access a lot of these the same complex thoughts or have the same amount of focus on these complex thoughts as someone of a more privileged background.
Yeah.
And I don't mean privilege in sort of an identity politics route, but in terms of like their economic capabilities, in terms of how they exist. And it's a very serious issue that I'm glad there's sort of some sort of mainstream sort of the discussion about it.
Right.
That and this also is a huge factor in connecting to sort of the rise of mental illness that's going on, because this increased amounts of stress is manifested in a chemical called cortisol, and these massive levels of cortisol and these different stress hormones are characteristic of things like depression, especially, and most notably anxiety, and directly linked to these other types of mental illnesses. So it should be no surprise that as, you know, as neoliberalism further privatizes, further destroys welfare and further destroys really the real wages,
job security,
the real wages that workers have, as Jeff was kind of talking about earlier, the real conditions that people are facing. It's no wonder mental illness, especially amongst youth, is rising.
You summarized the article perfectly, I think, but I want to give a few quotes for backup here. quote, when a person lives in poverty, a growing body of research suggests the limbic system is constantly sending fear and stress messages to the prefrontal cortex, which overloads its ability to solve problems, set goals, and complete tasks in the most efficient ways. This happens to everyone at some point, but people in poverty have the added burden of ever-present stress. They are constantly struggling to make ends meet and often bracing themselves against class bias that adds extra strain or even trauma to their daily lives. Think about the guy that got marched out of the food court at the Galleria.
He didn't like the food at that place. He didn't go, yes, sir, okay, I'll be out of your way. No, he was upset. I get it. That's obvious bias,
right?
Yeah.
By the way, I like the food at that Japanese place, at that little fast food place. That's a shame.
Yeah.
Among other things. Waste of food, waste of people's lives.
I didn't even want to eat after that. I was just like, really.
Yeah.
The whole scene just unfolding in my front of me, like, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that damage to the limbic system that it's talking about, it can be semi-permanent. Or sort of quasi-permanent to a significant degree and can be very difficult to recover
from. Then I get home to this letter. Thank you.
Yeah. And the science is clear, quote unquote. The science is clear when brain capacity is used up on worries related to poverty and fears, there simply isn't as much bandwidth for other things. And interesting, we were joking off air about the title of this. This is from Economic Mobility Pathways, or EMPATH, has built its whole service delivery model around this science, which is described in its 2014 report, Using Brain Science to Design New Pathways Out of Poverty. Well, I'm sorry, I read this. I'm on my second reading here. I missed the pathways out.
Same.
I didn't see that part. Because that's socialist revolution, revolutionary socialism, pathway out of poverty. And they're not mentioning that here. So they're taking an individualistic approach.
I think they do mention raising wages. They give that minor thing at some point.
They were saying if it happens, then blah blah.
They'll
say how to achieve that.
Exactly. Yeah. No concrete steps presented.
So anyway, I don't have time to go into that. They're so-called cures, which are not really even close to anything like that. It's going to empower them to understand that they can make a change. Thanks again for the individualistic solution to societal problems that's so much a part of the science that you're going to go into. Wake up. the red flag, metaphorically speaking, has just gone off here in the studio.
Yeah.
Gone up here in the studio but that's true of anything you study. So, hey, maybe we do have time to talk about Cornel West for 2 seconds.
Okay.
What did you say earlier? The Cliff Notes version?
The Cliff Notes version, yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, you know more about this than I do.
Yeah. So very recently, Cornel West, a philosopher and a significant socialist.
Back at Harvard now.
Yeah, professor. And
really, he's back.
Oh, yeah, he's back.
Awesome. Nice.
He was at Princeton. Yeah.
Yeah. Significant socialist intellectual figure made very serious and very correct sort of criticisms of Ta-Nehisi Coates, a major sort of liberal philosopher in his own right, so to speak. And in this sort of piece, it's an open letter, so to speak, that Cornel West published in The Guardian. He very clearly makes it a very clear indictment of a lot of Ta-Nehisi Coates's ridiculous assertions, especially around Obama and around neoliberalism. Essentially, Coates has this, and we've seen this a lot in the era of Trump, this sort of insane historical memory of seeing Obama as this glorious figure who we just need to go back to. And if we just went back to the Obama era, everything would be fine.
Yeah.
And in his most recent book, he's seen praising the sort of the tactics and the government of Obama as, and even at one point compares Obama to Malcolm X, to the modern Malcolm X.
Ouch. Yeah, I remember that. I did read that. Yeah.
And so that really set Cornel West off.
That is scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was
It did set him off.
Yeah. He'd set him off. And
let Malcolm S. Rex in peace, please.
Yes. You know, yes.
Like, he did his share.
I have a quote about that from a different interview, if we have time. Go ahead. Sorry,
but so that clearly did not sit well with West, and he wrote an entire article in The Guardian about it and has done a few interviews about it, as most notably in The Root, just talking about how Ta-Nehisi Coates has very much cemented himself as sort of the neoliberal petty bourgeois face, the sort of upper middle class face of the Black freedom movement. He doesn't present any real steps for organizing. He doesn't present even any real like positive things to move forward for the working class. He's just this sort of kind neoliberal face to sort of facilitate and pacify the Black working class to a significant degree, into just